I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and for the first time ever, a vaccine has prevented infection from the HIV virus that causes AIDS. Now, that vaccine only cut infection rates by 31%, but years of failed attempts convinced many researchers that a vaccine would never be successful. Let's start today with this news. Dr. Tim Johnson is medical editor for ABC News and a frequent contributor to Here and Now. Dr. Tim, in your view, how big is this news?
Well, it's big news, but it's not a breakthrough in the sense that this is now ready for treatment. The ordinary vaccine success rate that is targeted before commercial use is somewhere between 70% and 80%. In this particular trial, the researchers had even said that before they would consider licensing it or producing it for the Thai people where it was tested, it would have to be above 50%. So 31% doesn't meet either of those goals, but it does show, for the first time, that we can do something about reducing the infection rate. That excites researchers. They're obviously going to go over this data and this trial and find out why it worked, when it worked, and see if they can do a better job.
Well, and you mentioned the test trials took place in Thailand with 16,000 volunteers there. It was research backed by Dr. Anthony Fauci from the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases and the U.S. Army. How did they conduct this? What did they do with those 16,000 volunteers?
Well, that's another part of this complicated story. They divided them in two groups. One group got six shots over a six-month period with two different vaccines. They got a shot with one of the vaccine for the first 4 months and with the other vaccine for the last 2 months. And they used two different vaccines because they act differently. One boosts the immune system, the other sort of boosts white blood cells. And so they figured, even though these vaccines had failed when tried individually, maybe in combination they would work. Well, they sort of worked in combination. Now, remember, you're talking about giving six shots over 6 months. That's not easy to do anywhere, in particular in a third world country. But they did find that the ones who got the six shots of the real stuff had a 31% reduction in infection rate versus the ones who got six shots of placebo.
But doctor, are there any ethical questions raised here? Because that presumes that these people were allowed to go about what was probably risky sexual behavior, or maybe even got it through drug use or blood transfusion. But in any event, you know, these were people who were not told not to do those things because they were part of this.
Well,
this
in fact, they were, both groups were given counseling, were given condoms. So they were told to do the usual things. The point is that the ones who got the vaccine did even better than the ones who didn't.
Right. One of the worries with some vaccines is that a percentage of people who receive the shot might actually contract the illness. That happened with early polio vaccines. But we're hearing that's not an issue here.
That is not an issue because neither of these vaccines is made from whole virus, dead or alive. So it cannot actually cause HIV. They used genetically altered material, not the HIV virus.
Well, because, as we say, these test trials took place in Thailand, they used particular strains of HIV found in Thailand. Do we know that we can extrapolate that these shots might reduce infections elsewhere where there are other strains?
No. Simple answer, and that's one of the many problems that researchers will now wrestle with in going on with their research. We know that the AIDS virus mutates very easily, and so one of the great issues with any vaccine, but particularly with an AIDS vaccine, is you might develop it and then the virus mutates and it will no longer be effective. So there are many huge issues before we can begin to think about this as a product that we will give worldwide or even in any one country. One of the big decisions now, Robin, is are they going to go back to the people who got the placebo, at least, and give them the six real shots now? They had said they would do that if they got better than 50% results. They didn't, but I suspect there will be some pressure for them to do at least that.
Well, it sounds like the bottom line now is still that prevention of AIDS is behavior-related.
Very much so. And as Tony Fauci himself said about this research, this is not a breakthrough. This is a beginning.
Dr. Tim Johnson, ABC's medical editor and also a frequent contributor to Here and Now. Dr. Tim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Let's turn to the health care reform debate now. And much of it recently has focused on Medicare, the health care program for the elderly, which is run by the federal government. But Medicaid, the health care program for the poor and the disabled, may end up playing an even larger role in covering the country's 46 million uninsured. The federal government splits the cost of Medicaid with states, but states largely decide who and what services are covered. So, for example, in Alabama, a family of four qualifies for Medicaid if they earn less than $2,400. Yes, $2,400. But in Minnesota, families can potentially receive Medicaid if they earn less than $60,000. So why the disparity? How is Congress proposing to change things? And who will pay? Karen Tumulty is senior political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, let's do that primer again. First, what's the difference between Medicaid and Medicare?
You know, the Medicaid program was established back in the 1960s right alongside the Medicare program, but people really don't understand what it is. They think it's a health care program for the poor, but the fact is that in many, many, many states, to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be poor and something else. You have to be poor and disabled. You have to be poor and pregnant. Poor and elderly, or poor and with children. In many states, if you are a 55-year-old single person without a family, you can't qualify for Medicaid no matter what your income is.
And states use not only different rules like that, but different equations based on a percentage of the poverty level. You want to run over that? Although it makes our head explode, but go ahead.
Well, that's right. In some states, the program is a real bare-bones kind of thing. And doctors, by the way, in many of those states, don't want to participate because, you know, they'll get reimbursed as little as $9 for taking a Medicaid patient for a pediatrician visit. So you cross state lines, and it transforms into a totally different program.
Right. And let's talk about how states determine who's eligible. The federal government mandates that most poor children get medical coverage under Medicaid or the SCHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. But parents of these children are a different story. And states use a percentage of the federal poverty level. Now, that's $22,000 a year for a family of four, to base their calculation. So, for example, in Texas, families have to make less than 13% of the poverty level, or $2,800, to qualify. But in Maine, New Jersey, Wisconsin, they have to make less than 200% of the poverty level, or $44,000, to qualify for Medicaid, even with cost of living differences. That's a huge difference.
That's right. And the fundamental change that is being envisioned in both the House and the Senate in the Medicaid program is that for the first time ever, it would become, in fact, a true poverty program, a program that would actually be based for the first time on income alone. You could qualify for Medicaid across the country if you made 133% of poverty.
So you're saying any family of four across the country that makes less than $30,000 would qualify. And for singles, it's about $10,000. Anyone across the country who makes $10,000 or less would qualify. So it would be the same across the country.
That's right. And for the first time, for instance, single adults who are not disabled, who are not elderly, would be guaranteed access to the Medicaid program if their income was below a certain level. This is a fundamental change in the way this country has approached the Medicaid program.
Well, let's talk about some of the reaction to it. Some states would see a real jump in Medicaid recipients. We gave the case of Alabama, where you have to make less than $2,400 for a family of four. It would jump to $30,000, as we said. That's going to be a huge increase in Medicaid recipients in Alabama. States are balking at this. Why?
States are balking at this over one issue, and that is who's going to pay for it. Medicaid, unlike the Medicare program, is jointly administered by the states and by the federal government, and a big part of the cost of it falls on state budgets. For most governors, this could absolutely not come at a worse time because they are looking at trying to balance their budgets. They are cutting, slashing state services left and right, and now would come from Washington this big additional burden. At least that is the way it is envisioned in the legislation that is currently being worked on in the Senate Finance Committee.
But isn't that committee and aren't other plans also offering that the government help those states that are going to see a big jump, especially over the next few years, that they're going to subsidize this?
That's going to be a real question going forward, is how much the federal government is going to help the states pay for this big new responsibility that they would have. But in Washington, they're trying to keep their costs as low as possible on the health care bill. So you're going to see a lot of pulling and tugging between the federal government in Washington and the governors.
Well, here's some response. Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas said expanding Medicaid there would cost his state another $20 billion over 10 years to insure 2.5 million more Texans. But we understand some lawmakers, Democrat Charles Schumer of New York, but also Republican Olympia Snow of Maine, have also been balking because they're from states that already offer very high Medicaid coverage, upwards of 200% of the poverty level, way above, let's say, Alabama. And their thinking is that this bill is going to funnel federal dollars. As we said, the federal government's going to help the poorer states. It's going to funnel federal dollars into largely red states with lawmakers who get to rail against government health care while they are still going to benefit from it with an increase in Medicaid.
That's right. And a lot of states, they're saying, hey, wait a minute, we've been doing a good job. We've been very generous with Medicaid recipients in our state. And the people that you're going to reward are the states that really haven't been doing a good job, haven't been generous. By the way, there's one other issue that needs to go into this as well, and that is the fact that already it is difficult to find enough doctors who are willing to take Medicaid patients.
I was going to ask you about that, because when my mom went on Medicaid in New York, all her assets gone and she was ill, they required that she see a geriatrician in order to qualify, and we know there aren't enough.
That's right. And in a lot of states, you're finding, for instance, you can't find a pediatric dentist who will take Medicaid patients because the reimbursements are so low. So in a lot of states, they're saying, okay, we're going to have this big new influx of demand for health care services and health care providers, and we just don't have the providers.
So why are members of Congress pushing so hard for this?
I think that what they are trying to do is set up some sort of system that would deal with the great disparities that we see in the health care system from one state to the next. And, you know, ironically enough, as much debate as we have heard in Washington over whether or not there should be a so-called public option, there hasn't been a lot of attention focused to the gigantic establishment of a new government-run public option that would come with the revamping of the Medicaid program.
Is that potentially part of the big push for it, that if the feeling is, well, if there's not going to be a public option because there's been such pushback against that, this is the de facto public option?
It is another way of doing essentially the same thing.
But does it also ultimately save money, which we hear is what reform is about? In other words, to get poor people into some sort of Medicaid coverage, does that keep them from going to emergency rooms or waiting to get care until they're very, very sick and we have to pick up the tab anyway?
That's the theory, and that's the theory that I think underlies the much larger effort at health reform, which is that if people are doing their regular dentist visits, if they are getting regular checkups, if they are seeing a doctor for problems when they're small, they won't be seeing them in an expensive emergency setting when they get really sick.
That's Karen Tumulty, senior political correspondent for Time Magazine. Karen, thanks so much for walking through this with us.
You bet.
Okay, so if doctors aren't willing to take Medicaid patients, why expand the program? Well, maybe those doctors should have some incentives. We'll pick that up when we come back. Also later today, a soldier's suicide in Iraq. Now his father has questions about his son's superiors. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about Medicaid, the health care program mainly for the poor and disabled. Some lawmakers are hoping to expand Medicaid to cover up to 11 million of the country's uninsured, with the thinking that it will ultimately cut costs if people get some preventive health care before they truly become sick. But there are a lot of questions. The Urban Institute found that on average, Medicaid pays just 72% of what Medicare pays doctors for the same service. We just heard Time Magazine's Karen Tumulty say that because of that, doctors don't want to take Medicaid patients. The American Dental Association found that fewer than 27% of doctors surveyed treated Medicaid-insured patients. And, of course, there was that terrible, high-profile 2007 case, a 12-year-old from Maryland who died from an untreated abscessed tooth when bacteria spread. Michael Doonan is an assistant professor at the Heller Graduate School at Brandeis University. He also has worked at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, so he knows these systems. Mike, first of all, what's your answer in that many doctors don't want the lower Medicaid payments?
Yeah, this really is a problem, and lower reimbursement rates means that you could have a Medicaid card in your pocket but not get the care that you need. As you mentioned before, this varies from state to state.
Right.
Clearly, it's better than being uninsured. I know right now in the plan being considered by the Senate Finance Committee, they would actually increase the rates that they'd pay for primary care to the same rate that they're paying Medicare. So that would improve the program significantly.
Well, again, that comes back to the question of where's that money coming from. We'll get to that in a minute. But
right. By
the way, just remind us why, in particular, some elderly people would be on Medicaid when there is Medicare.
Right. Well, very poor elderly people can't afford the co-payments and premiums. So Medicare doesn't cover everything.
Right.
So this would help them pay their monthly premium and their deductibles. They're so-called dual eligible. They're eligible for both programs.
Right.
And also there's some things that Medicare doesn't cover, home care visits or nursing home. So they, especially the poor or the disabled elderly, need additional benefits.
Right. And so elderly often have to completely pay down their assets and wait a while so that they qualify for Medicaid. And I've shared here on this program about my own now late mom. And it reflects some of the unevenness of Medicaid care. Let's get to that, because New York offered her a full-time aide if she met the financial requirements, which she did. I'd rather have brought her here to Massachusetts, but Massachusetts only, Medicaid, only offered an aide for 2 hours a day. And many people here in Massachusetts have to quit their jobs to take care of indigent elderly.
Right. The way the Medicaid program is structured is that there's certain benefits that the federal government says a state has to have, but then there are other benefits that are optional. And it's the same with who's eligible for the program. As you mentioned, the big disparities between states, that states can set these eligibility levels. So the old saying goes, if you've seen one Medicaid program, you've seen one Medicaid program.
But do you think it can be made the same across the board, given that states are not in the same financial situations across the board?
Well, that's a good question. I think one of the biggest problems with the Medicaid program is that it was designed to be a safety net for the poor, but it's like a Swiss cheese program. There are big holes, and there are large numbers of low-income people that aren't even eligible for this program, so they're uninsured. So the question is, how can we insure them? And if we set a rate that everyone in the whole country can get covered at below 133% of the poverty level,
right. Then
we're going to have a safety net. We're going to have a true safety net. But that doesn't take away some of the problems that you mentioned.
Well, and one of the problems that many people cite, Douglas Turner, op-ed writer for the Buffalo News, writes that since Medicaid lacks strong central control from the federal government, it's ripe for wheeler dealers and crooks and abuse. Now, as you said, there's a proposal for a new cross-the-board qualification. It would be around $10,000 for single people, around $30,000 for families of four. You'd have to make under that to qualify. But I can see people looking at that $10,000 for single people. That's, people in their 20s maybe. Might there be some abuse of the system by people who really aren't indigent? They're just not making a lot right now. And what do you say about just the general question that it's ripe for abuse?
Well, I think that there are a lot of controls in the Medicaid program. The federal government oversees this program. So the states put up some money, and the federal government puts up some money. So the federal government has some oversight. They have regional offices that look over the Medicaid program to make sure that states don't abuse this program, because there has been a history of abuse. But right now, that's not a major problem with the program, and I don't think it will be going forward. And I think that's why there's pretty broad support. All of the healthcare plans have expansions of the Medicaid program.
Well, tell us about that support, because we'll be hearing about all the problems, the cost, the concerns about cost. So do you agree with backers, proponents, who say ultimately if you give more people insurance through Medicaid, it will ultimately bring health costs down?
Yeah. Well, one important thing that we haven't talked about yet is that this new healthcare reform is going to have an individual mandate. It's going to require people to get insurance. And this Medicaid expansion would help cover the lowest income folks, those below 133% of poverty. So if you're going to have a mandate and tell people to get insurance, are you going to tell someone with $10,000 that they need to buy a $4,000 health insurance plan? Or are you going to tell them that they have to have a big deductible private insurance plan?
But also to the question, once they get Medicaid, do you agree with the thinking that some health care will at least, I mean, we think of Karen Tolmati mentions the diabetes epidemic,
right.
that is the biggest drain, I understand, on the health care system, that some, at least some Medicaid care will prevent it from becoming acute and becoming a bigger expense down the road.
Yeah, you know, I think we're going to need to do some things like put the focus more on primary care and pay primary care docs more and give them the responsibility to take care of these patients so that a diabetic doesn't end up in the emergency room. I think that's a real concern, and we can make this better. But leaving these folks uninsured right now is the worst of all worlds. They get sicker, then they end up in the emergency room, and those costs get passed on to you and I and everyone who is insured. We pay higher insurance rates because of the uninsured.
That's Michael Doonan, assistant professor at the Heller Graduate School at Brandeis University, talking to us about Medicaid. And, of course, we'll keep taking bits from the health care reform debate as it goes on. Medicaid Today. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the latest on that terrorism case in New York and Denver. Did the police botch it? That's tomorrow. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba is not the only detainee dilemma for the U.S. American forces are now holding about 8,000 prisoners in two large detention centers in Iraq. Iraqi security forces are expected to assume control of those camps next year as part of the scheduled U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. A third U.S. detention center, Camp Booker, has just closed. The prisoners there transferred to the other camps. The BBC's Baghdad correspondent Hugh Sykes visited that camp as it was shutting down.
Since the invasion in 2003, U.S. forces have detained more than 100,000 people, most of them at Camp Booker. As the camp closed, the remaining 180 detainees were transferred to other camps near Baghdad. High-risk men, according to Brigadier General David Quantock, speaking here at a news conference at Booker.
We know for a fact, not just a guess, but for a fact, we know that they're very dangerous individuals, and that's why we've held them.
But if you know that, you have proof that they are. And
well,
if you don't have
no,
proof that they are,
because sometimes with intelligence, you cannot release the source of the intelligence because it compromises the intelligence and puts your source at risk.
From the air, Camp Booker, far out in the desert near the Iraqi border with Kuwait, looks like a town with grid-patterned streets. But as you get closer, you see rows and rows of huts, dozens of watchtowers, compounds surrounded by razor wire. It was officially known as a theater internment facility. It was named after a New York fire marshal, Ron Booker, who died in the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center. When it was opened, there were just a few tents here, surrounded by a razor wire fence. But Booker grew and grew.
If you can remember back to November 2007, we had upwards of 22,000 detainees.
A Camp Booker coach tour. They're keen to show reporters the legacy here, facilities for the nearby town of Mukasa.
On the left, we just passed the wastewater treatment plant, and we will come back here to talk about that later today.
But eventually we reach Compound 16, where the last of the detainees were held. From one of the watchtowers, we looked down at small groups of men wearing yellow tunics and baggy white trousers, walking round and round and round a fenced enclosure, 48 degrees in the shade, but there is no shade. They look fit and healthy. These are the red detainees, the men that General Quantock says he knows for a fact are dangerous.
If they were completely innocent, they would have been released with the other 92,000 detainees that we have released. We know, in fact, that most of them have blood on their hands.
How long have they been here, some of them?
Well, some of them have been there a couple of years.
So
3 years.
2 or 3 years without facing any due process.
We were at war. And until 1 January of this year, we were operating on the United Nations Security Resolution, which allowed us to take in security detainees. There's many short memories out there, but you can understand that the insurgency out there was wicked and killing many of our soldiers, killing innocent Iraqi civilians by the dozens. And all of a sudden, we're concerned right now.
You're sure you got the right people?
I'm absolutely sure we got the right people.
But an Iraqi MP and deputy chair of the Parliamentary Human Rights Commission, Shadar al-Abousi, insists that detention without trial is never acceptable.
if they have specific cases against them, they can keep them. They must have a fair trial. This is their rights, not to keep them without judgment.
And there are long memories here of prisoner abuse by American forces. This former Booker detainee, Kathir Majid, says that even if Booker wasn't Abu Ghraib, it was still an abuse to keep him there for 3 years without charge or trial. He was accused of carrying out sectarian killings for the Mehdi Army militia. He told me there was no evidence and that he never killed anybody. Eventually, he was released without charge or compensation. The Americans are now trying to do everything by the book, working with the Central Criminal Court of Iraq to assemble evidence that will stand up in court against the remaining detainees, or release them.
The BBC's Hugh Sykes reporting from Camp Booker in Iraq. In the meantime, Iraqi authorities are on the lookout today for 15 inmates who broke out of a prison in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown. Officials say four of the prisoners have links to al-Qaeda and were awaiting execution. A police officer says the head of the anti-terrorism department responsible for prisoner security has been dismissed. We'll be back after a quick break with a father's thoughts on his son's alleged suicide in Iraq. All was not what it seemed. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Top Navy officials announced this week that they'll revisit an inquiry into hazing at a U.S. Navy base in Bahrain. An investigation in 2006 found more than 90 instances of abuse. It was recommended that two officers be court-martialed, but instead, the unit's chief was promoted, a unit member who was expected to be questioned committed suicide, and the case was closed. Well, as we said, it will now be revisited. And there is another military hearing into alleged abuse, but in this case, the troops were not at a base. They were in combat in Iraq. Army Private Kiefer Wilhelm, an Ohio native, was deployed to Iraq this past summer. After about 10 days there, his family got the call that he had committed suicide. He was 19. Then the second shock, there had been reports that Kiefer was bullied, forced to exercise for hours. The Army launched an investigation that led to charges of cruelty and maltreatment against four of his superiors. A hearing is scheduled in October. Shane Wilhelm is Private Kiefer Wilhelm's father. Shane joins us from his home in Plymouth, Ohio. First of all, what a terrible loss. Our sympathies.
Yeah, thank you very much.
What were the thoughts that came first when you were told it was a suicide?
It was a lot of disbelief, but then again, we're not over there. We don't know the circumstances. I guess anyone, you know, it's been stated before, anyone's capable of suicide, but it just depends to what limit we're pushed to do it.
Yeah, and it didn't seem right about him. You said, you know, he always gave everyone big hugs. He was outgoing.
Yeah, not him. He never showed any signs of depression, or he really didn't have any signs of anger.
And Kiefer's mom, your ex-wife, says that she had some hint that things were not right. He called her. What did he say?
My understanding is that he had called her once and said that they were taking his things. They put rocks in his pockets.
Forcing him to exercise?
And, yeah, crawl in the dirt, do push-ups. Anyone wants to stay in shape when you're over there. But to put rocks in someone's pockets and crawl in the dirt until your legs bled, apparently, I think his last call was that she said she had told him, you know, he was going to be okay, he's going to make friends. And he said, no, I'm not. They don't like me.
Well, he also said he didn't have anyone to turn to there, and that becomes so telling as we hear that the Army has launched an investigation and has charged four soldiers, his superiors. Allegations include verbal abuse, physical punishment, ridicule. First of all, when did you hear that it was not all as it seemed?
Approximately 9 days after we got the original knock on the door from the two Army officers, we got a call or an email, I think, stating that there was four soldiers charged with maltreatment. They said not directly related to my son's death, but which could have led up to my son's death.
You also saw your son's death certificate. What is the cause of death listed as?
Pending.
To be determined. Well, so now there are these charges against four soldiers. Is it possible that another might be added to it? The Army originally told you he was found with his firearm by his side. Is there a chance that murder might be added to the charges?
It's a possibility. We just watched a segment on C-SPAN.org from Major General Nash stating that they aren't ruling out homicide.
Huh.
That's something new that we've just learned.
Well, and it also seems, has the Army been counseling you all along? I'm hearing you say you learned something just now on C-SPAN.org.
Right.
Why isn't the military telling you?
The military told us about the charges against these other four, and we have direct contact with our congressman. He's supposed to be a better liaison, a quicker political way to get information to us first.
Yeah.
Because of the other instances where we haven't received any information, we watch it on the news, and it's like, why aren't they telling us this? Why is this on the news and we don't even know about it? That was a whole other dilemma to deal with. I mean, we are getting some assistance here and there. Don't get me wrong. The military, you know, they're offering to pay for counseling and things of that nature also. But it's like I've told my wife, you know, I don't want to be medicated. I want to be able to feel all this until it's over. Maybe when it's all over and I can finally take a deep breath, I know I have to close the casket. I can finally relax and try to move on with my life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we know a military hearing is expected to take place in Kuwait in October, and you're trying to raise money to go there. Why? What are your hopes for the trip?
A little closure. Every day I think about this, it's like his casket's still open. I want to hear the statements that people make. I don't want the transcript portion of the trials. I would rather be there, and in case I get to stand up on behalf of Kiefer and his character and what kind of person that he was, I want to be able to stand up for my son just like any other parent would. I mean, I still want to protect him even though I can't bring him back. I still want to protect his name, and I want to hear firsthand what was the causes that led up to this. I mean, we all know the vague details, the maltreatment and the excessive physical punishment that he received and about his weight, and he didn't want to go out into public anymore because of that. But I'd like to hear the details myself firsthand.
Are these four accused of just doing this to Kiefer? Or was he scapegoated in the group? Or
it's my understanding there was three others that were in the same situation as Kiefer. We don't have any contact with them. We don't know their names. That would be another reason, because I believe they will be at these trials also.
Well, one of them, somebody blew the whistle.
Yeah, and it was too late.
Yeah.
And my son became the martyr for this whole investigation and the whole case.
Well, Shane, your thoughts, you know, if even some of what's alleged happened, your thoughts on that? There's hazing in boot camp, but these guys were at war.
Yeah, that's a little difficult to understand. And it was a non-combative zone, which means there wasn't enemy fire. They were there to train southern Iraqis to be better soldiers. How do you train another country or any other individual to be better anything if you're beating down your own people? Army of one, right? that's their motto. And I thought the Army operated a little differently. But in this particular situation, I believe it was particularly related to this one company. I served in the military myself also, and I've never seen anything like this. We all joke around with each other. You play a few pranks, but you don't tear someone apart like that from the inside out.
Well, Shane Wilhelm, again, the father of Private Kiefer Wilhelm, serving in Iraq when he committed suicide, and now four of his superiors have been charged with abuse. They'll have a military hearing in Kuwait in October. Shane, we'll link our listeners to a memorial fund that's been set up to try to help your family travel there. In the meantime, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And so if you want to support the Kiefer Wilhelm Memorial Fund, just go to our website, hereandnow.org. We'll be back in 1 minute, Here and Now. Where can you find a detailed diagram of the inner ear? a collection of drawings of different types of red blood corpuscles, or an illustration of how to hit a tennis backhand. Well, your dictionary, of course. And now an artist and bookbinder has categorized and reprinted thousands of these intricate illustrations used in the 19th century Merriam-Webster dictionaries and compiled them in a new book. It's called Pictorial Webster's, A Visual Dictionary of Curiosities. John Carrera joins us in the studio. John, this is such a fascinating thing to breeze through, hundreds of pages of these tiny dictionary illustrations. When did this interest start for you?
Well, it really all came about when I discovered this old 1890 dictionary under my grandfather's favorite reading chair. And in the back of it were ganged together and printed all of the images from the dictionary. And I thought, wouldn't it be neat to make a little book from these images?
Well, how did they make these? How were they originally made?
Somebody would draw a picture on wood. And then in the case of the 1859 dictionary, the first illustrated dictionary in America, this fellow John Andrew would, by hand, using these little tools, carve away anything that wasn't to be printed. And that's the way it's done today, too.
So much work.
An amazing amount of work.
You wanted to see if the original engravings still existed, so you called Merriam-Webster's. They told you they did, and you went to Yale, where they're kept. What did you find?
Down in this dust-filled, locked cabinet, there were cases and cases of about 13,000 of these little images. It was very exciting.
You found these thousands of engravings, and you put them in a certain order in the book. Some of the images make a grid, some form diagonals. But as you write, it also forces the images to engage in a dialogue. So you have two spiny crawfish on page 86 that seem to be facing off against each other. You have a marmot and a marsh harrier bird that look like they're talking to each other. Where are some other places where you have
these? Well, of course, the earwig looks like it's about to go inside the ear.
What were some that really jumped out at you, just in the either in the artistry or in the, wow, why did they think to illustrate that?
Well, there are a couple that really hit me to begin with. One was the image of the bloodhound on page 46. It has such a wonderful expression, and I discovered this note from one of the editors in the 1950 edition to another editor. They were talking about which images to keep in the book, and the editor writes, "I know this is not the modern breeding of a bloodhound, but can we keep him in because he so embodies the spirit of bloodhound?"
He's just all drooping.
Oh, it's such an amazing image. Yeah.
Well, you also discovered, looking through all the original illustrations, that Merriam-Webster used a Union soldier to illustrate dozens of things. I've just opened a page, and there he is. Order arms. He's standing at strict attention, so he's illustrating that call. At another point, he might be illustrating how to load a rifle. At another point, something else. And you've decided your next project is you're going to write a story about that guy.
Right. Because it's really one of these turn of events where I keep thinking I'm done with a book, and then something presents itself that I just can't let it go.
You've also said that you hope that the book inspires people to imagine stories. You know, and you can open to a page, and you can maybe try to think, gee, on the here's a G page. There's a gable. There's a gator, the thing that went down over boots back in the day. There's a gadfly. You've said you want to read stories to children. How would you do it with that page?
Well, I mean, I kind of have this gadfly with the gators thing coming up right away, where he's this guy who lived near a marsh, and he loved to look at the ducks, but he didn't like to kill ducks. He just liked to watch them. And he'd put on his gators, and he'd go out into the wet water. And one day he came across a gabion, which is an ancient thing that was used by Indians to capture fish.
Okay, and, I get it. There's the gabion right there on the G page. So it almost would encourage kids to make up their own story with 5-10 illustrations that you've put there.
Right, and that for me is part inspiration of this whole project. Is for me, I remember in sixth grade the dread of having to do the definitions from the dictionary, but seeing the little pictures is always what kind of made that project come alive for me, where you'd have to use a word in a sentence. But so here I'm turning it around, and you have to use the pictures and put them together to make a story.
John Carrera, thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Artist and bookbinder John Carrera, who's reprinted thousands of illustrations that were used in the 19th century Merriam-Webster dictionaries and compiled them in the new book, Pictorial Webster's A Visual Dictionary of Curiosities. You can see pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. Well, we have a few minutes for your thoughts, and many of you wrote to say that you appreciated our story with Yo-Yo Ma and his teacher, composer Leon Kirchner, who died last week at 90. Raymond Foss of Suncook, New Hampshire writes, "Tears were running down my face. How wonderful, the words, the music, the memories." Well, we also reported recently on Maine's new law, which penalizes drivers if they have an accident or traffic violation while distracted. Turns out other states have the same law. Judge Mark Nielsen in Racine, Wisconsin is on the line. And Judge, you tell us Wisconsin has had a distracted driving law for 30 years. Besides cell phones, what are the problems?
Cigarettes, playing with the radio or the tape player, yelling at the kids in the back seat, arguing with your spouse, that sort of thing.
And we understand that unlike the Maine law, in Wisconsin, you can get fined for these things even without getting into an accident or a traffic violation.
Oh, absolutely. I looked up a couple of cases. And in one case, they saw a motorcyclist going down the road with his feet up on the handlebars. He was reclining. They pulled him over, and they couldn't figure out what else to cite him for, so they cited him for inattentive driving, right, even though there had been no accident.
And we
By the way, he was acquitted. He may have had his feet up on the handlebars, but he was paying attention to what he was doing.
There you go. And we understand that the law was expanded to include television sets in the front seat.
It seems like common sense, but I have to tell you, I was terribly shocked a few months ago. I lease a car, and it's got this digital screen that shows the radio station and all that. And I inserted a DVD of some lectures, and all of a sudden, the picture section of it popped up on that screen. So I suppose technically I'm driving around in violation of that statute.
Arrest yourself.
Well,
Judge Mark Nielsen there in Racine, Wisconsin, thanks so much for weighing in on this.
Thank you for the opportunity to discuss it.
And finally, we heard from a lot of new listeners in Chicago this week, especially after we asked, "Toddlin' Town, what does that mean?"
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town.
John Murphy and Victor Salvo said it was a dance. David Sherman, who swings on Thursdays at the Green Mill Lounge with the Swing Shift Orchestra, adds it was kind of a side-to-side waddle, penguin-like. But Chicago Slim Nelson writes, "I always thought Toddlin' Town was a reference to the consumption of toddies during Prohibition, toddy being street slang for any alcoholic beverage. Of course, my impression may be based upon my viewing the world through cocktail glasses." And Leslie Dodson, who's actually over in Grand Rapids, Michigan, adds, "When sophisticated city folk from the coast came to Chicago, they considered the town a toddler. That's why they named the newcomer the Toddlin' Town." Well, staying with Chicago, Bill Lambert took issue with our saying that the city also gave us Al Capone. He writes, "Capone was born in Brooklyn. He became a mobster there. That's like saying that Boston gave us Billy Buckner to imply that the Red Sox all let balls go between their legs. Ouch!" Right you are. We'd love to hear from you. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
On State Street, that great street, I just want to say.
I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
That they never do on Broadway. Say, they have the time of their life. I saw a man and he danced with his wife in Chicago. Chicago. Chicago.